Stabler, Librarian of the Stettenheim Library here at Congregation Emmanuel of the City of New York, our full name. It is my great privilege to welcome you on behalf of our senior rabbi, Dr. David M. Posner, and John Stryker, President of the Board of Trustees. This evening, we feel especially privileged that Dr. Jonathan D. Sarna is giving the inaugural talk for this year's Emmanuel Reads. Professor Sarna's book, When General Grant Expelled the Jews, has and is being read by many temple members participating in our annual read-along, and the reviews are enthusiastic. You may be interested in two other Emmanuel Read events, a showing of the recent documentary, Jewish Soldiers in Blue and Gray, on February 20th, and on February 26th, Dr. Gary P. Zola, Executive Director of the Jacob Rader Marcus Center of the American Jewish Archives, will talk about his forthcoming book, He Was Like One of Us, Abraham Lincoln and American Jewry. Flyers with additional information are in the lobby. Emmanuel Reads is a collaborative venture requiring the efforts of many. Fran Hess, thank you for letting us borrow your family members every now and again. Thank you to Mark Weistuck and Mark Heitlinger, and you know why. Sherry Nehmer, who is handling the book signing, and our fabulous staff, Joe Bisram and Bobby Rambal and Clandy and all their crews, as well as the great guys at the reception desk. After the lecture, Jonathan Sarna will take questions and sign copies of his books. This lecture will be available on the Temple's website in a couple of weeks, www.emmanuelnyc.org. Rabbi Ben Zeidman, our wonderful assistant rabbi, will now introduce Professor Sarna. Thank you, Rabbi Zeidman.
So again, on behalf of our senior rabbi, Dr. David Posner, and our president, John Stryker, and our board, welcome to this Emmanuel Reads event, which inspires the Temple Emmanuel community to learn and grow together each year, with innumerable thanks to Liza Stabler, our temple librarian. 150 years ago, General Ulysses S. Grant suggested to the Jews of America that this country might be yet another place where they were unwelcome. In the context of the world, there was nothing new about General Orders No. 11. However, the story that followed and the subsequent years of President Grant's life is anything but ordinary. How the order was handled by those immediately affected and by President Lincoln, and how it affected the American Jewish community at large is quite a story to tell. How it affected President Grant, though, was personally the most fascinating of all. Who better to chronicle these important years than Dr. Jonathan Sarna, the Joseph H. and Bell R. Braun Professor of American Jewish History at Brandeis University, the chief historian of the new National Museum of American Jewish History, and one of the most important scholars of American Judaism in the world. Dr. Sarna has been involved in the writing of more than 20 books, and American Judaism, a History, is the backbone of classes on American Judaism in rabbinical schools and in universities around the country. And now he presents us with a new challenge. Should the Jews forgive Grant? Dr. Sarna, you enrich us and enlighten us. It is with great honor that I welcome you back to Temple Emmanuel.
Well, thank you very much, Rabbi Zeidman. It's really a great privilege to be back here at this historic congregation. When I, as a historian, think of who has spoken here, I'm always particularly honored, and I'm very grateful. I'm especially grateful that the Weather Committee arranged to hold off the snow just for enough hours that I can get back. And, of course, I'm always glad for the opportunity to be with Aunt Franny Hess. And let me also put in a good word for the other two programs in the series. The film is fabulous. Even if you saw it on PBS, this is the long version. They cut it greatly. He did a magnificent job, and as for Dr. Zola, that is really an incomparable opportunity, and the story of Lincoln and Jews is really extremely interesting and little known. But now we turn to Grant, and the truth is that the subject of my lecture and of my book really once put my entire academic career in jeopardy. In 1982, I was a faculty member at the Hebrew Union College. This is before you were there. And they invited me to deliver a talk before the Board of Overseers of the college. As anybody in academia knows, that's a very important rite of passage for a new faculty member. I was very determined to prove myself. And since 1982, more or less, and indeed the lecture, more or less coincided with the 120th anniversary of Ulysses S. Grant's General Orders number 11, expelling Jews as a class from his war zone, I decided to take that infamous 1862 order as my subject. And on the appointed day, I came out, put on a new suit. Everything seemed to be going well in my talk until I broached the rather sensitive subject of smuggling. U.S. Grant was deeply concerned about smuggling between the North and the South, and since some of the smugglers his troops caught were Jews, he concluded all Jews were smugglers. And I pointed out in the lecture that we now know that smuggling was rampant throughout Grant's territory. It was by no means a Jewish monopoly. In fact, I enthusiastically continued, Grant's own father, Jesse Grant, was engaged in a clandestine scheme to move southern cotton northward, and his partners were the Jewish clothing manufacturers Harmon, Henry, and Simon Mack. Well, no sooner were those words out of my mouth than chairs began to shift uneasily in the room in Cincinnati, and my mentor, the pioneering American Jewish historian Jacob Rader Marcus, buried his face in his hands. I knew I was in big trouble. Clearly, I had made some terrible mistake. I didn't know what it was. I'd read the documents, but not knowing what the problem was and fearing for the security of this new job of mine, I hobbled to the end of my lecture and invited questions. An old man in the front row sitting just where you are promptly raised his hand and rose to his feet. My name is Mack, he memorably began, and looking me straight in the eye, he announced, that was my great-grandfather you were talking about. And then there was a kind of long, dramatic pause. It's all true. And at that point, the room relaxed, and Dr. Marcus looked up, and everybody smiled, and my academic career was saved. It took me about 30 years to get over that experience, but when General Grant expelled the Jews, I have returned to those notes concerning Grant and the Jews, and I hope that the story remains full of interest. Now, General Grant's order number 11, dated December the 17th, 1862, read as follows. The Jews as a class, violating every regulation of trade established by the Treasury Department and also department orders, are hereby expelled from the department within 24 hours from the receipt of this order. We might have expected, in the face of that kind of order, that thousands of Jews would have been evicted from Grant's territory, which is really a large area stretching from northern Mississippi to Cairo, Illinois, and from the Mississippi River to the Tennessee River. Memphis alone, after all, was at that time one of the largest Jewish communities in the South. But surprisingly, very few Jews were actually expelled, certainly some were. Some were expelled from the area of Holly Springs, Mississippi. Others, as we'll see in a moment, were expelled from Paducah, Kentucky. But most Jews, notwithstanding Grant's order, remained unaffected, and for a long time, I wondered why. The answer lies buried in the 130 massive volumes known as the Official Record of the War of the Rebellion. The title hints at which side produced the official record. There we learn that just hours after issuing General Orders Number 11, Grant's forces at Holly Springs were surprised by 3,500 Confederate raiders. And as part of those raids, the dreaded cavalryman, General Nathan Bedford Forrest, tore up 50 miles of railroad track as well as telegraph lines. And that is really the key to the mystery. Because the telegraph lines were cut, communications between Grant's headquarters and the military command were disrupted for weeks. And as a result of that, Grant's order spread very slowly and didn't reach the various headquarters in a timely fashion, sparing many Jews who might otherwise have been banished. Now, a copy of General Orders Number 11 finally reached Paducah, Kentucky, a city which had actually been occupied by Grant's forces very early in the Civil War. It's on the border, 11 days after it was issued. Today, I'm not sure anyone would be surprised if it took 11 days for something to move from Holly Springs to Paducah, but, you know, we'd say that's what the mails are. But in those days, that was a very long time. There were about 30 Jews in Paducah in that time. Most of them were merchants, and they were really divided in their loyalties, much like the rest of the population. Some supported the Confederacy, some the Union. Owing to the war, corruption ran rampant in Paducah. It's right on the border. It was a hotbed of smuggling, and recriminations abounded. Not for the first time in such cases, suspicion fell particularly upon the Jews, long stereotyped as being financially unscrupulous. Even though they were very few in number, they played an outsized role in business and trade in Paducah, and they were immigrants, so they were easily marked by their European accents and foreign ways. Unionists and Confederates alike doubted their loyalties. So it was that Caesar Caskell, a staunch Union supporter, as well as other known Jews in the city, one of them is an ancestor of one of your most distinguished members, Robert Morgenthau. On his mother's side is a Fatman, and the Fatmans were among those expelled from Paducah. And after the book was already published, the Morgenthau sent me a document, which was the document expelling their ancestor from Paducah, which they had the good sense to to preserve so everybody would know it happened. And all of those Jews, Kaskel and Fatman and so on, were handed papers ordering them to leave the city of Paducah, Kentucky, within 24 hours. Women, children were expelled too, and in the confusion, so it was recalled years later, one baby was almost forgotten, two dying women had to be left behind in the care of neighbors. As they prepared to leave, Caesar Kaskel and several other Jews sent a telegram. Imagine having the presence of mind that you're being expelled, and they sent a long telegram to President Abraham Lincoln describing their plight and pronouncing themselves greatly insulted and outraged by this inhuman order, the carrying out of which would have been the grossest violation of the Constitution and our rights as good citizens under it. Now, Lincoln probably never saw that telegram. He was, after all, busy preparing to issue the Emancipation Proclamation. That's dated January the 1st, 1863, and we're in late December of 1862. The irony of Lincoln freeing the slaves while Grant was expelling the Jews was not lost on contemporaries. In fact, one newspaper published the two documents, one above the other. And the juxtaposition of those events also shaped the responses of several Jewish leaders to Grant's order. Jewish leaders feared that Jews might be replacing blacks as the nation's stigmatized minority. That was the great fear of the Jewish community. Oh, you're going to free the slaves. Now you're going to look for another outgroup to persecute. That's what this order is about. That's what they feared. But so it is understandable that Caesar Kaskel wasted no time. On my way to Washington in order to get this most outrageous and inhuman order of Major General Grant countermanded, he announced, and like a Civil War era Paul Revere, he rode down to Washington spreading news of General Orders number 11 wherever he went. It's really due to Kaskel, who was a merchant and knew about publicity, that everybody heard about the order. He wrote a press release, which he handed to the Associated Press. He informed rabbis everywhere where the train stopped, and that's how Americans began, certainly Jews, began to hear about the order. He eventually gets down to Washington just as the Sabbath is concluding on the 3rd of January. And he'd gotten good advice. He immediately goes to a friendly Republican congressman whose name was Gurley, who enjoyed ready access to the White House. And together, they go over to see Abraham Lincoln. Those of you who saw the wonderful film Lincoln know that one of the characteristics of Lincoln's White House was that he was open to all sorts of people who would come and see him. And if you came with a congressman, he would often go out of his way to admit you and hear what was on your mind. Well, of course, Lincoln turned out to know absolutely nothing about General Orders number 11. It hadn't reached Washington. And according to an oft-quoted report, he resorted to biblical imagery in his interview with Kaskel, a reminder of how well Abraham Lincoln knew his Bible, and a reminder of how often 19th century Americans linked Jews to ancient Israel and America to the Promised Land. And so, Lincoln is said to have drawled, the children of Israel were driven from the happy land of Canaan. Yes, Kaskel replied,
And that is why we have come unto Father Abraham's bosom, asking protection. And this protection, Lincoln declared, they shall have at once. Now, even if the conversation didn't exactly go that way, although this is how it was remembered years later, we do know that Lincoln instantly instructed General-in-Chief of the Army Henry Halleck to countermand General Orders Number 11, and 2 days later, urgent telegrams went out from Grant's headquarters in obedience to that demand by direction of the General-in-Chief of the Army at Washington. The telegram read, "The general order from these headquarters expelling Jews from the department is hereby revoked." And there was then a follow-up meeting. Many Jewish leaders had rushed to Washington when they heard of the order. Even before they got there, Lincoln had overturned the order, but having made it such a distance, they weren't going to turn around and go home. Instead, they gather in Washington, and they also want to meet with Abraham Lincoln, who meets with them. One of those leaders who writes a report of the meeting is the great leader of Reform Judaism. We'll meet him again in a minute, Rabbi Isaac Meir Wise. And thanks to him, we have a verbatim transcript of the discussion. And he tells us Lincoln reaffirmed that he knew of no distinction between Jew and Gentile. And then Lincoln said something very significant. I almost wish that Spielberg had included this Lincoln line in his film. "To condemn a class," Lincoln said, "is, to say the least, to wrong the good with the bad. I do not like to hear a class or nationality condemned on account of a few sinners." Still worth remembering in the 21st century. In retrospect, we certainly know that Jews were not the only victims of human rights violations during the war. War inevitably leads to human rights violations. That's true even in our day. But Jews were the only religious minority expelled as a class during the Civil War. Anti-Jewish prejudices certainly existed and were heightened during the Civil War by the prominence of several Jews, most notably Jefferson Davis's right-hand man and cabinet secretary, Judah P. Benjamin, in the ranks of the Confederacy. Senator Benjamin Wade had a wonderful line about Judah P. Benjamin. He called him an Israelite with Egyptian principles. Wonderful line. I don't think, though, the Jewish Confederates were the only cause of prejudice in the Civil War. The truth is that smuggling and speculating and price gouging and swindling and producing shoddy merchandise for the military all were similarly laid upon the doorstep of the Jews. In the eyes of many Americans, including many in the military, all traitors and smugglers and wartime profiteers were sharp-nosed Jews, whether they were actually Jewish or not. Just as all Northerners were Yankees, so all smugglers and crooks were Jews. Now, there is absolutely no doubt that some Jews did illegally enrich themselves during the war. I had the good fortune to gain access to the archives of the famous Jewish fraternal organization, B'nai B'rith. Now those archives, by the way, have been transported and moved to the American Jewish Archives in Cincinnati, so anybody will soon be able to use them. But I used them in Washington, and I found a secret communication
in the archives. It's a secret, so don't tell anyone. And it read, quote, "Information has been received here, doubtless authentic, proving the fact of certain of our co-religionists being engaged in an illegal traffic and other acts of disloyalty with those who are in rebellion against the government." But if that's the cause of Grant's order, meaning that he identified a widespread practice, smuggling with a visible group, the Jews, and blamed Jews as a class for what was, in fact, an inevitable byproduct of wartime shortages exploited by Jews and non-Jews, civilians and military men alike. If that's the cause, the occasion for the order, December the 17th, 1862, has long remained mysterious. Why then? It's especially mysterious because Grant had overturned certain kinds of orders against groups just days earlier. The answer to that question brings us back to my opening story. We now know that in mid-December of 1862, Grant received a visit from his 68-year-old father, Jesse R. Grant, accompanied by members of the prominent Mack family of Cincinnati, significant Jewish clothing manufacturers. Any Mack descendants here? Yeah, I was asked. Harmon Henry and Simon Mack, as part of an ingenious scheme, had formed a secret partnership with the elder Grant in return for 25% of their profits. He agreed to accompany the Macks to his son's Mississippi headquarters to act as their agent to purchase cotton and then to help them secure the means to transport that cotton to the port of New York. You could make 400% on your money smuggling during the Civil War. Cotton was very cheap in the South and sold for a great deal of money in the North, so it was very tempting. According to an eyewitness, Ulysses Grant, when he learned of this scheme, waxed indignant, as they wrote, at his father's crass attempt to profit from his son's military status. And he raged at the Jewish traitors who entrapped his old father into such an unworthy undertaking. He refused to provide his father with the permit, sent the Macks homeward on the first train north, and in high dudgeon immediately issued the order expelling Jews as a class from his territory. In a way, it's a classic act of displacement. The general expelled the Jews rather than his father. Now, Ulysses S. Grant never defended his actions, not even in his long and justly celebrated personal memoirs written just prior to his death. One of you before the lecture came up and said, "I read Grant's memoirs." I don't remember him talking about this episode, and that's exactly right. And in fact, it's no accident that he left out the episode. His son, Frederick Grant, who helped his father with the memoirs, later reported that he'd asked his father, "Shouldn't we say something about General Orders Number 11? And his father replied, "That was a matter long past and best not referred to." So it's not in the memoirs. But Julia Dent Grant, who was Ulysses' wife, she was far less circumspect. You know, sometimes it happens what husbands like to forget, their wives like to remember. And so in her memoir, she actually goes out of her way to mention General Orders Number 11, which she characterizes as nothing less, this is her word, than obnoxious. The general, she writes, felt that the severe reprimand he received for the order was deserved, for he had no right to make an order against any special sect. Now, maybe had Ulysses S. Grant himself expressed such sentiments back in 1863, the whole course of his subsequent relationship with the Jewish community might have been different. But as it was, he found himself compared in some Jewish circles to historic enemies of the Jewish people, a rather long and ignoble list. The favorite comparison, and we're now coming up to the holiday of Purim, the favorite comparison was to the wicked Haman, vizier of Persia, and of course the villain of the Book of Esther. And those who remember the book can see why they chose that parallel. And precisely that comparison came back to haunt General Grant when he ran for president in 1868. Thanks to his Democratic opponents, who used the order to curry favor with the Jews, it was hard to tarnish U.S. Grant's reputation, and suddenly they said, oh, look at that order. We can use that, and maybe we can win over Jewish votes as well. And suddenly, General Orders Number 11 becomes an important election year issue. It's really the very first time that a Jewish issue stood front and center in a presidential contest, and Jewish politics really moved to the forefront of a presidential campaign. The problem for many Jews was that they choked at the thought of voting for Ulysses S. Grant. How do you vote for Haman? But they strongly supported his Republican Party's liberal policies on Reconstruction. After all, the Democrats wanted to reverse Reconstruction-era laws. Their goal was to disenfranchise black voters altogether. So Jews who supported the Republican policies on Reconstruction faced a very difficult conundrum in 1868. Should they vote for a party they considered bad for the country, meaning the Democrats, just to avoid voting for a man who had been bad to the Jews, meaning Grant? Fascinatingly, two of America's most distinguished Reform rabbis debated how Jews should vote in newspaper columns that dueled, really. Liebman Adler, who was the rabbi of Chicago's oldest synagogue, often known by its initials, KAM, argued against voting on the basis of Jewish interests and in favor of broad American interests. Proud as he was of being a Jew, Rabbi Liebman explained, it is different when I take a ballot in order to exercise my rights as a citizen. Then I am not a Jew, but I feel and act as a citizen of the Republic. Even if the political party he thought best for the country were to place Haman at the helm of state, his response would be, he said, prosper under Haman, my fatherland, and here you have my vote, even if all the Jew in me mourns. Rabbi, that was too much for Rabbi Isaac Meir Weiss. He couldn't disagree more with that idea. if wrong is wrong, he who defends it is wicked. Wise declared, of course, he was a lifelong Democrat, and he came down forcefully against Grant. Well, when the votes were finally tallied, Grant emerged the winner by more than 300,000 votes, a healthy 134 electoral votes. The Jewish vote, which, by the way, people greatly exaggerated in 1868. I think they still exaggerate it today, but it certainly made no difference in the election. And then there is this amazing epilogue, which takes place after the election, so no one can accuse Grant of pandering to the Jewish vote. He suddenly releases an unprecedented letter. After all, we never got a letter from Ferdinand and Isabella saying, sorry, we expelled you. We certainly never got a letter from Tsar Nicholas, forgive me for those pogroms. But Ulysses S. Grant releases a letter that told Jews just what they wanted to hear. I have no prejudice against sect or race, but want each individual to be judged by his own merit. Order number 11 does not sustain this statement, I admit, but then I do not sustain that order. And during his presidency, Ulysses S. Grant went out of his way to demonstrate that his apology was genuine. He actually appointed more Jews to public office than all previous presidents combined. He was the first president to have a Jewish advisor, Simon Wolf. There is a descendant here in our midst. He is the first president to attend a synagogue dedication. The dedication, no president had ever attended a synagogue dedication, but he goes to the dedication of Addis Israel. If you've been to Washington, you may know Addis Israel congregation. The dedication was held close to the 100th anniversary of American independence in 1876, and Grant sat for 3 hours in the Washington heat listening to speeches at the dedication. That's real penance. And Grant also intervenes actively when Jews are persecuted in Russia, in Romania. He actually appointed an unpaid Jewish consul to Romania, Benjamin Franklin Peixoto from a distinguished Sephardic family, and he goes to Romania with the mission of aiding Jews laboring under severe oppression. His presidency is really remarkable. I've only touched on highlights, but I actually devote, I can't give the whole book away, but I devote 2 chapters which are very little known. In retrospect, the years of Grant's presidency represented something of a golden age for American Jews. During that all too brief period, Jews achieved heightened status on the national scene. Judaism won recognition, at least from Grant, as a faith co-equal to Protestantism and Catholicism. Anti-Jewish prejudice declined, and Jews everywhere looked forward optimistically to a liberal epoch characterized by sensitivity to human rights and inter-religious cooperation. When Grant died in 1885, he died the very same week as the greatest Jew in the world at that time, Sir Moses Montefiore of England, and astonishingly, the two men were linked together in the American Jewish mind as heroes and humanitarians, and many synagogues and temples mourned for the two men at one and the same time. What a change from 2 decades earlier. That would have been
unthinkable. It shows how much Grant's reputation had been transformed. But subsequently, after Grant's death and in the early 20th century, Grant's reputation sank like a stone. 20th century historians, the so-called Dunning School of History, many of them were openly critical of his benevolent policies towards African Americans. Some of them were Southerners who never forgave Grant for Reconstruction policies that he championed, and they criticized the way he waged war and the way he forged peace. They blamed him, and many of you probably learned this, they blamed him for a long litany of Civil War era ills, and they ranked him close to the bottom among all American presidents. At one time, only Warren G. Harding ranked lower. You can't get any lower than that. And the truth is, Jews joined in that outpouring of criticism. Standard Jewish histories, the Encyclopedia Judaica, still quote General Orders number 11 and forget everything that happened later. But a reexamination of Grant's career makes clear that he really deserved better. His transformation from enemy to friend, from Haman to Mordechai, from a general who expelled Jews as a class to a president who embraced Jews as individuals, reminds us that even great figures in our history can learn from their mistakes. Hatred can be overcome. Thank you very much. I'm happy to take questions. Yeah.
It's not on. Oh, yeah.
Okay. Professor, with all due respect to your marvelous talk.
Testing. Is this on?
Turning the volume up.
Okay.
Take a moment.
Your comment.
I'll repeat it. Yeah, I'll repeat it. You come. You speak, and I'll repeat your question. Just talk.
Testing.
Okay. I'll repeat it, right. Yeah.
You made the comment that the entire Union military scapegoated Jews when it came to corruption. That's how I understood you to be saying. In fact, there was at least one general who did not, John Adams Dix, who was the commander of the Department of the East here, and he aggressively went after many fraudsters and deserters and spies, none of whom, as far as I know, were Jewish. If they were Jewish, he never knew it. And some of them were executed right here on Governor's Island. So I'm not sure I understand how you arrived at that assumption that all fraudsters were thought to be Jews by members of the Union.
Yeah, I hope I didn't say that all members of the military thought that, but I think there were members of the military. If you read Sherman's letters and other letters, you can see that they use smuggler and Jew as synonyms. And indeed, what's quite fascinating, there's a wonderful correspondence between Butler and some members of the Jewish community. And Butler talks about various individuals who were Jewish and who had unsavory reputations. But the amazing thing is, almost none of them were Jews.
He just imputed Judaism. But you're perfectly right that it is always bad to generalize for all. There certainly were people, and I mentioned some others in the book, who went the other way. There's at least one officer who really refused to carry out General Orders Number 11 because he considered it illegal. So it is, I think, whenever there are human rights violations, there are individuals who go along, say, we have a problem, we solve it in that way and don't think about the individual. And then there are heroes who have a moral conscience, even in war, and who turn out very different. So thank you for reminding us of that. Please.
I want to ask you about abolitionism. One of the things I learned from your book is that Jews in the North, who one might expect to be anti-slavery and reasonably liberal in today's terms, weren't really drawn toward abolitionism because it seemed to be the realm of radical, pretty right-wing, anti-Semitic Christians, Protestants. So my question is about abolitionism. Was it not a mainstream notion? Was it really radical? And if that was the case, then where fell all the people who would have presumably thought that slavery was a bad institution?
So, first of all, there were certainly some Jews. A good example we don't often enough think of women, Ernestine Rose, the great feminist, who were, I think, abolitionists, Sabato Moraes, Rabbi David Einhorn, who served here for a while, they were certainly in league. But many Jews feared that the abolitionists were really overwhelmingly evangelical Christians who had an agenda against Jews. And after all, you can draw a straight line from abolitionism to prohibition to anti-abortion. In all of those cases, these are individuals from a strong evangelical bent who believe that this is a moral crusade to purge the country from grave sin. And Jews were nervous about that. And when you read what William Lloyd Garrison, who I obviously a great hero of abolitionism, but when you read what the kind of language that Garrison sometimes used about Jews, one cringes, a reminder that there are great figures who nevertheless are when it comes to Jews, have a blind spot, and Jews saw that blind spot. So just to finish the answer, you can find Jews everywhere on the spectrum in terms of slavery. You can find anti-slavery, you can find staunch defenders of slavery, and you can find people who sort of wanted to find a middle ground. Rabbi Rafal here in New York made a famous sermon arguing that slavery was found in the Bible and therefore it must be justifiable. Indeed, he pointed out, and we read it last week in every congregation, it's in the Ten Commandments. If you don't remember slavery in the Ten Commandments, go back and reread Exodus 20. Of course, David Einhorn pointed out that by that logic, we should go back to polygamy. It's also in the Bible. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, then maybe we should bring it back. But what they were really arguing about, of course, is how literally do we read our Bible and what do we learn from it. But you can find every position on slavery. Please. Yeah.
Yeah, Dr. Sarna, thanks so much for a wonderful and balanced presentation. My question, I know it's a difficult one to some degree because we don't have exit polls, obviously, and some of the data that we have with modern elections, but do you have a hypothesis as to which candidate won the Jewish vote in 1868 and a rough idea, or at least a theory, as to what the margins might have been?
So I, one of the things I was glad to find, it was a poll, essentially. A journalist visited the B'nai B'rith Convention in 1868, and he reported 90% of those in attendance are heart and soul opposed to Grant. I don't think 90% of Jews agree on anything. But I do think that there were Jews who really struggled, and I talk about that in the book. I knew of a diary, it's at Yale, where a young Jew named Louis Erich, who I think for a time was a member here, then he moved to Denver, he struggles. It's his first time voting, and at the end, he writes, at the end, he couldn't bring himself to vote for someone who had done such wrong to the Jewish people. Peixoto, whom I mentioned, who later serves under Grant, in the first time, admits he did vote for Grant. But on the other hand, your relative Simon Wolfe, he supported Grant. He loved Grant so much, he named one of his sons Adolf Grant Wolfe. The name Adolf went out of fashion in Jewish circles for reasons you might be able to imagine, but in those days it was common. So you had Jews on both sides, and my guess is that while the Republicans would have had more Jewish votes had somebody else run, they certainly got numbers, but I couldn't give you how many Jewish votes. And of course, there were plenty of Southern Jews who hated Grant and wouldn't have voted for the Republicans under any circumstances.
Do you see any evidence of a shift in 1872?
Huge.
Anecdotal?
In 1872, but remember that in 1872, there is a Republican landslide. Greeley ran a foolish campaign, by then, Grant had proven himself to the Jewish community, and I won't search for it again, but they go back to B'nai B'rith, and they're all supporting Grant now, and apparently that's how you found out how Jews would go. You'd send a reporter to the B'nai B'rith Convention, and my sense is that, like, Grant in his second term won one of the great landslides in American political history, and my sense is Jews voted with them. There may have been some who never forgave him, and you can certainly find in newspapers some negative things about Grant, but there's a clear sense that Jews had shifted.
Hey, thank you.
Thanks, yeah.
Thank you, Professor. Wonderful speak.
Thank you.
Speech. You know that old joke about Lincoln wakes up and he says, "I freed the who?" And I think that perhaps General Grant, when he came out with the order, at that time he wasn't a politician. He didn't become a politician till after the war. By coming up with this Law 11, he went over the head of his commander-in-chief, who was surprised, according to all sources that we've read. This would have been a very, very foolish mistake for someone who was never really in the favor of the people in Washington until after the war, till after he won. What do you think about that? That maybe he did what?
Well, I think later Grant tries to explain. He explains on various occasions. But the one I found most persuasive was when he said, you know, we had a problem, and I was a general, and, you know, one needed to solve the problem. And if it had been, he gives another example, I think redheads who I caught smuggling, I might have expelled, you know, all of them. It's not quite satisfactory, but it is correct. The generals were taught, you're the general. If you have a problem, you solve it in a big way. And you can see in the Civil War how generals often would issue sweeping orders. And I think that's, you know, what he did. And sometimes, you know, when you look back, those orders were unconscionable. Your story about Lincoln, I thought you were going to tell the story about Lincoln and Grant. People complained to Lincoln that Grant drank too much. Actually, Grant only drank when he was away from his wife. He never drank with her. But anyway, Lincoln is supposed to have stroked his beard and said, you know, find out what he drinks so I can send a case to all the other generals. and in you know, that sense, I think it is part of the wisdom. I was thinking about it really in the case of General Petraeus, that Lincoln understood that there was a military need to keep Grant. He was his best general. He ignored those who wanted so to punish Grant as to throw him out. And obviously, thanks to the very deft and clever way that Lincoln, on the one hand, made clear he didn't agree with the order, but on the other hand, stuck with Grant. Of course, Grant was on his way to Vicksburg. That's his first victory, and that changes the, you know, the Vicksburg changes the character of the war, and he then goes on and wins it. So once again, it's a kind of reminder how cleverly Lincoln dealt with some of these issues.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And
Dr. Sarna will be signing books. Mark, we're outside, right? Outside. So bring your books, and we have them to buy, too. So thank you very much.